We have a few questions, so I would like to ask first, I would like to read the first questions and then ask Professor Lobova for her concluding remarks. So the first question is for, first question is to Matt. Could you comment on your views on the use of national and state security contracts, which you have discussed in our recent papers?
Sure. So I think that was wonderfully addressed just a moment ago. So I don't want to retread what Martin has just said. But I think obviously, as he was speaking, what came to my mind was that we are seeing perhaps something like a re-securitization of the party state in a global context. And I'm probably late to this idea. I'm sure that it's come out before. But the links then to me with the Political Legal Commission vis-a-vis the National or State Security Commission together would be that under Xi Jinping, and we see this every time the Politburo meets or the Politburo Standing Committee meets, or in other high-level meetings, Xi relentlessly pushes on this sense of danger and almost crisis that the party is facing. And I know there have been recent attempts to interpret this as Xi saying, well, you know, this is a crisis, but in this crisis, there is opportunity and this is China's time. But at the start of his tenure as General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, I think Xi was extremely clear that he felt that if the party did not regain control over China and over China's external affairs, then it was going to collapse. And that included managing cultural flows, managing economic flows. And so everything that he's done since coming to power has been intended to set up, to position the Chinese Communist Party for continued success indefinitely. And so this sense of a profoundly insecure environment, in some ways, I think is the impetus for both the formation of the National or State Security Commission and also the reorganization of the Central Political Legal Commission as a tool both of social stability at home, but then potentially also as a tool, as yet another tool of ensuring China's security abroad. That's the main connection that I see.
Thank you very much. We have one question from Kate Sanders for Nadej. And then there is one from Didi as well. Let me start with the one for Nadej. There are occasionally opportunities to pick up subtle critique of party policy in scholarly papers produced in the PRC. Does this also apply, even if it's rare, to the output of Chinese think tanks? Nadej, please.
Yeah, it's really difficult to discern any, you know, dissenting voice in the publications of the Chinese think tanks on specific topics. The ones I'm most familiar with are the ones related to the Belt and Road, and the description or the image I usually use for them is the idea of a school of fish. So basically, Chinese experts or scholars are their individual, but they're all going into the same direction. They're all traveling in the same way, following the same waves. And so, yes, there are individuals and they might have their own perspective on specific topics, but when you accumulate all their writings, you see that some elements do not belong to those discussions. They're not even talked about. So for BRI, for example, you will not find almost any Chinese expert who is critical of the idea in writing. They might find ways to say, you know, there are potential challenges or obstacles that are going to come along the way, but never do they say this was a stupid idea and the implementation is ridiculous and we should do things differently. You would find this 100 times in, you know, the Western equivalent of think tanks. If they have to discuss, I don't know, the free and open Indo-Pacific strategy, for example, you will find people who say it's not enough or it's not great or you're missing a lot of what should be done in the region. I mean, critical voices. This is not happening in the Chinese context about this specific topic of Belt and Road. I suspect that it's the same with any other policy that that is discussed, but I can just talk for this one because I've been looking at this one in more detail. So the basically it's this it goes with this idea of saturation of the space. You know, you repeat the same ideas over and over, and you just elude everything else, and the rest does not even exist in this thinking space. And therefore, after a while, when you repeat it in international conferences, I mean, BRI has been, I started to keep count of it, of how many conferences abroad were organized around Belt and Road, and then very quickly I stopped because there's too many of them. And when you repeat the same things over and over again, it's like it becomes ingrained in your mind, and you don't allow other views or perspectives to be expressed. And then that means that these other alternative views are cornered and minimized, and ultimately they just they're discredited. It's what Matt was saying, you know, more and more today you see that people think that it's BRI is completely disorganized and scattered, and it's absolutely not coordinated, which is completely ridiculous if you just look at how it's organized at home domestically. As Martin said, if you just look at it on its own terms, how the system itself is creating structure at home, you quickly realize that, yeah, okay, there might be areas where it's it's not necessarily well done on the ground, but it doesn't mean that it's not structured and organized centrally. I hope I've answered your question. Thank you
very much, Nadezh. Didi, if you have a question, now it's time, please.
Thank you, I do. And just thank you so much for three really wonderful, wonderfully interesting addresses, presentations. It was really thought-provoking. I'll try and be really quick, but I do have one question for all three of you, I know, individually, and I hope that's okay, because it's a precious opportunity to talk in a group. Nadezh, I wanted to ask you about the funding by the CPC or its organs of foreign think tanks. And you said that it doesn't directly fund, but goes via, for example, business people. What does it mean then when one discovers an example of it indeed trying to directly fund something, for example, in a European country, perhaps together with a local foundation of some kind, but the actual money and the actual partner is very much from the CPC and is actually a core organization of the United Front. I'd be really fascinated to hear if you've come across that kind of example before, where and how you interpret, or how we should interpret what it means when one does discover such a strong example of very direct connection or intervention or attempt to intervene in a foreign think tank from Beijing. That was my first question. I don't know if I should I just quickly say the other two points, how should I do it? Cut.
Maybe let's at first to let people answer.
Of course.
Thank you.
Thanks, Didi. This is it's a very interesting and very key question, because it goes back to this idea that Martin expressed, which is, if you apply your own perspective on the Chinese Leninist system, you will not understand really how it works. And so why did I say that there's no state funding of foreign think tanks? I said in the US, and it's because there's a lot of entities over here that are studying transparency and making sure. There've been different transparency reports, and on their tables, you don't see the PRC as a state funder to US think tanks. So I'm not saying that it doesn't exist anywhere. I have seen examples of Chinese embassies also jointly organizing or sponsoring events in different countries. But of course, it's information that is more difficult to get in countries that are not as transparent as the US can be in this particular case for its own think tank organizations. But then you are absolutely right. You know, you need to consider United Front organizations as part of not the state, but as Martin said, the party state. So it's the boundary is completely blurred here. But I think that the Chinese actors are using this ambiguity to blur the lines between what is state and what is not. You know, when you have a company like Tencent or Huawei who are sponsoring some conferences on specific topics, is it the Chinese state or not? You know, so people would discuss about that, and because they have this appearance of being private or not linked to the state, then they are maybe more acceptable actors. And I think this is exactly what you see in this space with think tanks, where you have a variety of actors who are not necessarily government per se. I mean, as in the West, we would identify them. In other words, not a ministry, but are linked to the party state. Like those, you know, businessmen who are part of the CCPCC, or companies that are state companies or that are nominally private, that are taking also advantage of these blurred lines to finance those places. So I think they really use those cracks to push for their influence there. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking a little bit about something different in that this is an actual United Front, a core United Front organization that attempts to directly fund and to be part of programs in major foreign think tanks. I take your point about the blurred lines, but I'm wondering at what point this becomes a sign of weakness, and on a perceived sign of weakness on the part of the target country, where the party may feel they can get away with it because people won't pay any attention, something like
this. It's what Lulu calls the weaponization of mediocrity, which is, you know, the local don't necessarily understand how this works, and so they don't know who are they're interacting with. And so then Chinese actors would take advantage of that and come directly without even trying to be behind proxies.
Yeah. So it's almost like a kind of a measure of how they see the other country, of how ill-informed they believe it is. Thanks very much. Yeah. Can I just, sorry about doing this one by one like this, but I just really did have some questions. It's all very interesting. Matthew, you talked about the Zhengfa system going internationally and its international impact. And can you hear?
Yes.
And that prompted this question in my mind when I wrote a paper for Synopsis about what happened in Hong Kong, the taking over of Hong Kong, essentially, for the state security law there. And the head of police in Hong Kong now himself was in Interpol for many years. But when you look at what he did in Interpol, you will not find much of a record. And you also will not find much of a record of what he did in Hong Kong after returning from Interpol. And I was just wondering, is this something that you're studying? Is this an example of what you're talking about with the Zhengfa system going kind of global and influencing police or legal or security global structures? And I wonder if you could just talk about a bit more about that, because that was super interesting.
I was just going to say, Didi, that I really liked your paper. You put a lot of, sort of pieces together, and it's that kind of integrative research that I think is very exciting these days. So you made part of the case that you just described already. I would say with respect to Europe, actually, and you know, this ties back to thinking about the role of Interpol also, is that and potentially also not to the United Front per se, but sort of China's, I think at this point, visible agenda of integrating its institutions with institutions of global governance. Anyway, Europe and the European Commission have played, I think, a pretty important role from a certain perspective in providing training and consultation to China's police, and in terms of fostering dialogue between China's political legal institutions and international political legal institutions. And so that's what I hear in your question to a certain degree. I think that not all of that should be, at least from my perspective, viewed immediately through a lens of suspicion. There are issues like human trafficking, where I think that there is genuine collaboration that is possible. And so, you know, the idea that funding and training from European countries is feeding back into the repressive aspects of the Chinese state is not always well placed. But on the other hand, I do think that that is an issue and a question that needs to be asked. We talked about a revolving door, in Washington, D.C., for example. Well, maybe there's a revolving door in Brussels or in other places where there are international organizations and, expertise, training, insight, information that those organizations can provide to China's state actors, again, may be beneficial, may help to solve global problems as a whole. But on the other hand, these are serious questions that need to be addressed in terms of thinking about how the rotation of officials from China's political legal system, which has been, I think, presented numerous times during the course of this workshop, created a very spotty, to put it mildly, record for itself in the area of human rights. How this cooperation has elements of enabling that might be seen as undesirable and maybe should be seen as undesirable. So that's, again, that's kind of what I hear in the backdrop there. In terms of the specific case of Hong Kong, I can't really comment on that one too much, but knowing, I think, as many of us do, that officials who are involved in state security areas often operate undercover, or their activities are not necessarily particularly well known or understood. Anyway, great question.
Yeah, I mean, the issue then is how disappointing it is that we cannot, for example, find out from Interpol more information, you know, so that's a problem on our side, of course, you know, and whether that's a question of kind of elite capture, essentially, in the West, the where the Western elites then go along with. Do you have any proposals for how one can deal with that?
Personally, the proposal I find most compelling is transparency. You have to start there. So, you know, you're addressing exactly that point. If there's opacity, because the kinds of collaborative efforts that I'm talking about, some of them are years in the making already. And so catching up to that reality is where we are now. We aren't ahead of it, we're behind it. And so demanding more transparency would at least be one place to start.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Didi. Thank you for questions and answers. And I'm sorry our time's running, so I will give the floor to Professor Lomová for closing remarks. We have a few more questions in our chat, so maybe if you have a time to answer them in our chat, it will be great. I think there's one for Nadezhda, they're waiting, maybe for next year. So, Professor, the floor is yours.